In today's episode, I've got a special guest joining me. He's a former Miami Dolphins wide receiver, Greg Camarillo. He's going to be joining me to talk about his whole NFL career, his famous game-winning touchdown catch against the Ravens, his time with Chad Pennington. We get some stories about Ricky Williams, Ronnie Brown, the Dolphins making the playoffs during that 11-5 year under coach Tony Sparano. We talk about that. We talk about him coming back from his devastating ACL injury. He shares his road to recovery, which was really, really interesting. You guys are really going to enjoy this whole conversation. And we also talk about life after the NFL, what he's been getting into now, what he's up to. Overall, it was a great conversation getting to talk to an athlete and just hearing his stories. You guys are really going to enjoy this. And lastly, the Miami Heat playoff series has begun. This past Saturday was game one, so I'm going to be talking about the first two games of this series and giving you my thoughts as well. So we got a jam-packed show here today, so let's get right into it. Welcome to the Miami Sports Vibes Podcast, episode 19. I want to take the time and thank you all for listening to this podcast and the continued support that you've been giving me via social media. It means a lot to me, so thank you for that. And before we get started here, I just want to let people know that if you're listening to this podcast and you're not following me on Twitter just yet, my Twitter handle is @sportsvibes305. So you can all follow me there if you aren't already. And you can always share your thoughts as well. Feedback, good or bad, or questions about anything. I'm an open book, so feel free to message me there at any point in time. And also, I want to share that if you're listening to this podcast via Apple Podcasts, if you can do me a favor and subscribe, rate, and review my podcast, I'd really appreciate that a lot. So let's get right into this conversation with former Dolphins wide receiver, Greg Camarillo. All right, everyone. So I want to welcome Greg Camarillo, the former NFL wide receiver for the San Diego Chargers, New Orleans Saints, Minnesota Vikings, and yours truly, Miami Dolphins. Greg, thanks for taking the time and joining me here today. How's it going, brother?
Going well, man. Thank you for having me on.
For sure, for sure. So I want to get into your college ball. So you played college ball in Stanford, and you went undrafted in 2005 and signed with the Chargers as a free agent. Tell me about that whole process and your perspective and mindset after not getting drafted, but then finally getting that opportunity to play in the NFL.
Yeah, well, I had learned through my football journey, when an opportunity comes, you have to be 100% ready for it. And I learned that the hard way. So as I was a walk-on going into college. I was a walk-on punter/receiver, not because I was great at both. I was mediocre at both, but, you know, they figured they'd give me a shot. And my very freshman year, I had a chance to play as a punter. I was thrown out there in practice to get two reps to show that I could perform, and I failed. And I put out two terrible punts. So early on in my football career, I learned the importance that you need to be 100% ready when an opportunity comes. You fast forward till the end of my college career. I was a good receiver. I wasn't great. I had no looks at getting drafted. Like, that wasn't even on the board. But I figured I'd give it a shot anyway. And unfortunately, you know, I got a chance to try out with the Chargers, and I had 5 practices over 3 days, and that was my opportunity. You know, it was everything that I could have asked for. You know, here's an undrafted guy on an NFL field with a chance to prove himself. And from what I'd learned before, I needed to be ready. And this time I was 100% ready. I put together 5 good practices and got an invite back to training camp.
That's amazing. Cause I always wondered, you know, how that mindset is when you, if you go undrafted and you get that opportunity, like how you really have to be locked in. So I can only imagine how it was during that whole moment for you there.
Yeah, man. I mean, my whole mindset with things like that going into anything really is, if I'm prepared and I put my best out there and it doesn't work, well, then F it, I tried, you know, I gave it everything I got. But the lesson I learned from college was, if I'm not prepared and I fail, that's all on me, 100% on me. And I wasn't going to let that happen again.
Right. All you needed was an opportunity.
Yep.
And after 1 year with the Chargers at the age of 25 in 2007, you became a Miami Dolphin. My favorite team, of course. So it was nice seeing you play with the Dolphins. And hey, that first year, I know you know where I'm going. You had a memorable play that all Dolphin fans remember. It was your first year. You secured the game-winning 64-yard touchdown catch in OT against Baltimore, which ended up being our first win after starting the year 0-13. Obviously, that season was tough. But what was that moment like for you to make that game-winning touchdown reception? Because, I mean, as a dream, I'm pretty sure everybody thinks about, let me make a game-winning touchdown. Like, you envisioned that as a kid. So what was that moment like?
Yeah, man. I mean, you nailed it. Absolutely. A dream of childhood dreams coming to realization. You know, I always wanted to be on SportsCenter Top 10, and I got to number one. And that's just, it feels good to know that, you know, you've busted your ass so long and then you actually get to achieve something that, you know, little 10-year-old Greg wanted to achieve. But like Nando, like we were saying, it was opportunity. So I was cut from San Diego, picked up in Miami because I knew Coach Cameron. He was here in San Diego with me before. And then I was, I think, the sixth of six receivers at the beginning of the season playing special teams. If someone got hurt, we traded Chris Chambers. Another guy got hurt, and suddenly I'm fourth. And going into that game, I had one catch for 2 yards. So we're not like, I'm not a go-to guy by any means. Like, no one's even looking up my name on a scouting report. Like, he's not on the offense. Don't worry about him. But then there came that opportunity. So we went four wides, ran the same exact play three times. I got three catches. And, you know, kind of like we talked about before, I was going to be 100% ready when that opportunity came. Fortunately, you know, the opportunity came at a great moment, and I scored my first touchdown since high school, which is wild. I didn't even score in college, and suddenly here I am running the open field in the NFL. And then just the excitement of being in a big moment on a team that had such a hard year, celebrating with teammates, that sense of relief that we wouldn't be the worst team ever. It was an exciting moment, not just for me personally, but, you know, as you know, for Finn fans all around.
It was crazy because during that whole season, I was just wondering, like, oh, come on. I just want one win, man, you know? And then that moment was so special. Like, me, other Dolphin fans will never forget, even though it was a tough season. But that moment was great for you and for Dolphin fans. And you did make it number one on SportsCenter. I do remember that clip. But it was awesome. But like we were saying, 1-15 that year. And you had so many, you know, competitive guys in that locker room. What was it like? Because you guys almost won a couple games and you couldn't get over that hump and pull out those wins. So what was that moment like week after week, knowing you battled, but you couldn't just rack up wins?
Yeah, man. I mean, you know, it's week after week. So you come in, you know, the work week basically starts on a Wednesday in the NFL, and you come in and you give that week everything you have. You're not worried about the next week. You're not thinking about the playoffs. You literally start Wednesday. And you give everything you have, learning whatever offense is in that week, and then physically preparing for that, and then a battle on Sunday. And it's crushing to do that week in and week out and lose close games. Then, you know, we weren't getting, well, some games we got blown out, but there were a lot of close games, like 3-point games, 1-point games, 5-point games. And so those are the ones where you battle, and you come up empty handed week after week. And then we went to London. We played in London week 8. And so that was to travel that far and then lose another one and come home 0-8 into a bye week. It's just deflating. Like, it sucks your energy.
I can't even imagine. Like, if I was out there, you know, because it's a whole lot to prepare yourself physically and mentally for these moments. And, you know, you come so close. It's just, and then you have to quick turn around and just try to bounce back and win another one the next week. But like you said, there were close losses in there. One of the guys that was on that roster was one of my favorite players growing up, and that's Ronnie Brown. What was it like playing with him, even though I believe he only played first seven games that season? What could you tell me about Ronnie Brown?
Yeah, Ronnie's awesome. Ronnie's one of those type of dudes where if you don't get along with him in the locker room, there's something wrong with you. Like, he's just an amazing athlete, a great person, a good leader. And then, you know, you just saw the value of him truly a year later. Like you mentioned, he got hurt that year, but a year later when we pull out the Wildcat and see that he can basically play quarterback and running back, just shows you why he was drafted so high. An amazing athlete, smart player, just a good leader. Like, that's the type of dude that you build a team around.
For sure. So the year after that was definitely a memorable one for Dolphin fans, especially, and for yourself. 2008, you guys won the division with a record of 11-5, clinched a playoff spot, which is pretty damn hard to see here in Miami. But that season, you were on pace for an amazing second year with the Dolphins. You and Chad had a really good chemistry going on. Dolphins offered you a 3-year extension, which was well-deserved, by the way. And then you suffered a torn ACL, unfortunately, against the Patriots, sidelined you for the rest of the year. It was nice to see you bounce back the following year, but what was that moment like, you know, to watch the team succeed down the stretch, get into the playoffs, and not being able to continue to contribute down the stretch?
Yeah, man, it's hard. Hard on a number of levels. So that was my, you know, my first major injury at the pro level. Fortunately, I'd signed a contract 4 days before I got hurt, so I knew that they were invested enough in me where I would get a chance to come back. But one, you want to be out there. You know, anytime your team's doing well and winning, you want to be on the field enjoying that with them. And then, you know, I'm not quite sure how to say this, but like, it's hard to watch a team have success without you. It's like, not just do you want to be out there, but it's also like, oh, they don't really miss me at all. They're doing just fine. And that's a testament to the other receivers. You know, Devon Best stepped up major right there. Ted Ginn stepped up. And so it's hard to see a team win without you. As much as you want them to win, you want to be part of that, of those victories. And that all culminated with the playoff game. So the team went on a monster run, then go to the playoff game, and I'm on crutches. I got a knee brace on, and I want to go to the game, but you can't be on the sideline like that because you're a physical liability. So I'm in the stands. Like, I'm literally crutching through. Yeah. What was it? I don't even know what the stadium was called back at that point. Sun Life Stadium, maybe.
So many different names, bro.
Yeah. I mean, I'm literally crutching through, and I go sit down just like anybody else. And to the point where the guy next to me during the game, literally telling his buddy to his side, he's like, "Hey, whatever happened to that Camarillo guy? He was pretty good." And I'm sitting right next to him, and I'm looking at him like, "Oh, I want to say something." But yeah, man. I mean, what a great, fun, exciting year. And I really wished I could have stayed healthy to be part of the whole thing.
I wish so too, man. You, like I said, you were on pace for a great second year. You and Chad had that chemistry going, and I mean, we got smoked in that playoff game. I could just imagine you sitting in that seat, just itching like, man, if I was out there, you know, I could maybe make a difference. Cause like I said, you and Chad really had that thing going, bro.
Yeah.
And it must have been tough.
Chad Pennington was everything the Dolphins were missing and didn't even know it. That dude came in and like literally day one, his leadership took over. Amazing guy, great quarterback. I owe a lot of my success to him because his quarterback skills brought me up. But I mean, that Ravens playoff game was a total slaughtering. And the only good thing about that is I probably wouldn't have made much of a difference. One guy in those games like that probably wouldn't make much of a difference. But that's just, that Ravens team was good, you know, and that we weren't ready for that moment. But it's all right. The Dolphins will be back in the playoffs sooner than later.
For sure. So yeah, we talk about Chad. You guys added Chad Pennington before that season, and new coach in Sperano. He was in charge. And the crazy thing is, you guys started the season 0-2. And right after that, you went 11-3 to finish off the year. Ever since then, and what turned things around really was that famous Wildcat game, like we talked about earlier, where you guys went to New England, had these guys fooled. You went on the road 38-13. Ronnie Brown making plays left and right, hauled in 4 touchdowns. You hauled in 4 for 60 in the win as well. Can you tell me about that moment? What it was like being able to see all these different type of things offensively with the Wildcat, and what was the feeling with the team during as it everything was going down?
Yeah, I mean, 0-2. We started out 0-2, coming off of a 1-15 year. So you're only thinking like, oh shit, here we go again. But fortunately that we had better leadership that wouldn't let us go in that direction. So we practiced as Wildcat. And I remember thinking, and I've talked with Ronnie about this, that going into the game, like we're gonna run these plays. It's either gonna be a embarrassing disaster or it's gonna be amazing. There's not gonna be like an in-between. We're not gonna run the ball for 5 yards and just say, oh, that was all right. It was either going to be SportsCenter not top 10 or SportsCenter top 10. And fortunately, it worked flawlessly. And there's nothing better than seeing a confused, frustrated, angry Belichick on the other side. And it was like, you know, like a signature moment for Dolphins football.
It was amazing to see. I'm, you know, going on the road, going to New England, it's tough to win there. And what you guys were able to pull off, I was like, holy shit, like they really got him. And you can tell Bill was frustrated. He didn't know what to do. And it was just that moment right there. You'd never forget it as a Dolphin fan. And I'm sure you as a player as well. But you guys had Ricky Williams on that team. Any interesting stories you can share about him? He was one of my favorites growing up as well. He's just so fun to watch him run the ball and then, you know, wear the visor and all that. What was it like playing with Ricky?
Awesome. It was like having a like a life teacher alongside of you. So, I mean, the guy, football was only like the tip of the iceberg with Ricky. He's just a super interesting human being that's always, you know, looking to expand his knowledge. So, I'd walk out to practice and I'd pass by Ricky's locker and he'd just be sitting in his locker, like reading a book on philosophy. And, and it's just not, you don't see that in a football locker room, but a super deep, thoughtful guy. I would just kind of ask him at times in practice where the offense wasn't going and the defense was going, I'd always look to Ricky to get a story and find out about, the years that he left the NFL, went and lived in a tent in Australia. The dude has stories, has knowledge. And then on top of that was just a dominant football player. So all around, just a fun guy to be around.
That's great, man. I always looked up to Ricky watching him growing up. Was always one of my favorite Dolphin players. I had one of his jerseys, man, as a kid, and I kept it for so long. I did not want to give it up, even though it didn't fit me. I kept trying to fit into it for years. So that's great to hear that about Ricky. So overall, you guys had a good season. Obviously lost that game at home against the Ravens in the playoffs. But the following year, the amazing news was that you were able to make it back the next year coming off that injury. You had 50 receptions and didn't drop a single pass thrown to you, which is incredible coming off an ACL injury. How were you able to get past the injury and make it back? Because I know injuries could be tough for people. And sometimes, we hear that it's a struggle, not only physically, but mentally as well.
Yeah. Like I mentioned before, I had signed a contract 4 days before. So they were basically invested in me and didn't have much of an option, but to give me a chance to recover. Training staff was amazing. I'd go in there 5 days a week and just do rehab all day. And that gets you back to a point where you can play. And then, Chad Pennington, that whole time, man, I would never have been the receiver I was without that guy as my quarterback. And so that was huge. And then, we had a great group of receivers. I'm still real close with Ted Ginn and Devon Bess. And it was just like so many different cogs of the offense, parts of the offense that could work that you really could just plug anybody in there and it's going to be all right. I was just very fortunate to be in that situation where I had time to recover. I knew that I could plop right back into the offense and not skip a beat. And I was, the more I look back at it, the more grateful I am for that opportunity that I had as a receiver.
Yeah, no, that's great. I mean, does it ever go through your mind, like during a play where, hey, if I run a certain way, like, were you thinking about any of that stuff at all? Like, were you worried about re-injuring or, anything like that?
Yeah. When you first come back, that first hit is always scary. But you wear a brace and they tell you that your leg is fine. Like, it's going to be okay. You just need a couple hits to get it back. And if, fortunately it worked. It takes basically 2 years. So you're your same athletic self, but a year later you can still play, but like jumping off of my injured foot, not going to jump as high. But that going into it and you adapt and adjust and play ball.
Right. Right. How long was the recovery? Is it 8 to 12 months? Is that the proper?
Yeah, about that. So I had surgery at the beginning of December and then I was in training camp in August. I wasn't near 100% in August, but come the season. So what's that? 11 months later. I was ready to go, not as explosive, but good enough.
Right, right, right. That's always interesting because, the ACL injury is, it's like you see it a lot of times in sports today. I feel like you see it more now for some reason. I don't know if it's just me. So I always wondered how that whole recovery process is for sure. So that season you bounced back, you guys finished 7-9 after dropping the last three games, all close games too, which was a letdown. So I can only imagine how bad you wanted to taste that playoff atmosphere that you missed the year before. But it was impressive watching you play. But how was that just missing the playoffs due to those dropping those last three games, man?
Yeah, I think Chad Pennington had been re-injured during that season. Chad Henne had come in, who's still playing, which is amazing. I love cheering for that guy. He's got himself a Super Bowl ring. But, some years they just don't click like the previous year. And you also have to think that Tom Brady was healthy that year. The previous year he had a knee injury. So there's always the Patriots you're dealing with, but you give it your all, you push for those playoffs and it doesn't happen. And I got to enjoy my first off season in 2 years. Cause after getting injured, I didn't get an off season. So it wasn't all that terrible.
Right. Right. So the following year, you ended up getting traded to the Vikings. You played a couple years there. and finish your career with a brief stay in New Orleans. But what was that transition moment like from playing in the NFL, steady grinding year after year, coming back from your injury even, with the training, the overall preparation, to living life after the NFL with your family? And what do you have going on now?
Yeah. All right. Well, let's go backwards. So right now I live in San Diego. This is permanent home base. I got a wife and three kids, three little girls at home. And I work as a coordinator of scholar athlete development in the University of San Diego's athletic department. So what I do is try to help student athletes transition into college, do really well in college, and then be prepared for life after college. And like you mentioned, that transition time for me, generally smooth with some speed bumps. So, you know, I was very fortunate to have played 8 years and, you know, save enough money where I didn't have to jump into a job right away. So I went to graduate school, learned that I wanted to work with scholar athletes and volunteered as an advisor. And here I am 6-7 years later, still doing that same work. The tough part of that transition is, you know, I've been a football player pretty much my whole life. Football was everything that I did, everything that I talked about. Football gave me emotional highs. It gave me a daily release, a daily like measuring stick, you know, like, did you work hard today? You know, here's your physical proof that you worked hard today. And then suddenly that's gone. And so, you know, you don't have that same schedule. You don't have that same physical outlet, that same emotional outlet. And then, you know, that big chunk of your identity is gone. Greg, the football player, doesn't exist anymore. Conversations aren't about football anymore. It's just, it's a big chunk of your life that has to change. And I'm not saying that's unique to football players. I'm not asking for anyone's sympathy or anything like that. I'm just trying to explain the mental transition that a lot of guys struggle with.
Right. No, I wonder that, because I hear a lot of podcasts with former athletes and that they talk about the transition and that it's completely different and it takes a lot of time to get used to. But I never personally asked one myself, so thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, yeah.
So if I do hear a lot that athletes, when they're asked, what do they miss the most after being retired? And NBA players usually say they miss the locker room the most. So how about you? What do you miss most about your time in the NFL? Like, if you had to pinpoint one thing.
Yeah. I'll give you two things. And clearly, I miss the locker room. That's not the number one thing, because you can still hang out with some guys and try to get a little bit of it, even though it's not the same thing.
Right.
And this is not something I would have said I missed when I was a player, but I miss the good feeling, the emotional high of knowing that I went into a weight room or a workout and busted my ass and gave it everything I had. Or played in a game, played in a practice, and physically gave something, everything I had, because then, you know, you walk away from that day and you get a sense of pride, a sense of accomplishment, knowing that you did your personal best. And to me, that's what success is. If you gave something all you had, that's being successful. In the real life, you don't have that. Like, I don't wake up and, you know, go make breakfast for my three kids and be like, man, I killed breakfast today. Like, I dominated that breakfast. Like, or, you know, I don't line up at work and have a contest about writing emails. Whereas in practice, I line up against a DB to go one-on-one and I beat him. And that feels great. Like, that's just, okay, all that hard work is paying off. And so I don't get that daily measuring stick of how hard am I working? Is it working towards success? You know, I may bust my ass in my career for 5 years before I really get, like, you know, a raise, or I get a new title, or I get to do something, you know, that really shows the progress of that hard work. So I miss that. I miss that feeling of being sore. I miss that feeling of not actually throwing up from a workout, but the thought that I know I worked so hard that I did throw up from a workout, or that feeling of, you know, making a diving catch in practice and having your boys pat you on your back. I miss that a lot. And then the other part is just, and this is kind of aligns with that, having a very specific goal every day, every week, every year. Like, I'm trying to help myself get better, my team get better, so we can go win games, so I can make a roster, so we can win a championship. And in normal life, you can set your own goals, but they're not as specific, and you can't have that daily measuring stick. Am I progressing towards that goal?
That's great, man. Putting that into perspective, that's just solid points. I mean, that kind of, if I was in the NFL and then all of a sudden not in the NFL, kind of having those goals that you set, and you have the things that you want to achieve and that you work so hard to try to get over that hump. I certainly would miss that as well. A couple questions before we wrap up. Well, first of all, I mean, you made it, man. I mean, from going undrafted, you know, being at Stanford, walk on from punter to wide receiver, getting that through a 3-year extension with Miami, playing a good career. And yeah, I mean, hey, that's major props to you, man, because yeah, I mean, the whole thing, man, from going undrafted, a lot of people can fall into that bad space and give up. But you pushed through, man. And then injury, you pushed through. So major props to you for being able to persevere through all those things, man.
I appreciate it, man. And that means a lot. So I thank you. And I do have to say that the Finn fans that persevered our 1-15 year, those are the real ones right there, man. I love hearing like people recount that story, because I know that the people that were still watching come week 14, when we finally got a victory, those are real fans. Because I mean, I can't say that I've watched a team that I cheer for lose 13 times in a row, and then I still sign up to watch another one, man. So I got a lot of respect for the diehard Finn fans too.
Yeah, man, I witnessed it, and I'll tell you one thing. I know it was stressful for you, but it was stressful for us watching it. And I just, like I said, I was just really grateful for your catch, man, because we didn't want to get on the bad side of history, you know, going 0-16. So trust me, bro. Like I'm grateful for your moment for sure. Couple fun questions here. Who do you think was the best cornerback that you went up against during the NFL? And who was your favorite matchup, like where you got extra pumped to face? It doesn't even have to be a person. It could be a team.
Yeah. Darrelle Revis, hands down, the best cornerback. Like, not even close. The dude was amazing. So much so, like, if you line me up against him, I'll just tell the quarterback, like, don't worry about me, man. Go over there. And I have no shame saying that, because the dude was a monster. Most pumped to play any of my former teams. So I spent my time on 4 teams. Anytime you get to play against your boys, it's extra meaningful, and you want to win so bad. And I got a chance to do that in Miami. We played against the Chargers 2 years after I had left, and I scored a touchdown. We won. Like it was everything I wanted it to be. So, you know, anytime I play my former team or play my former teammates, I love that the most.
Right. I do hear that a lot. Listening to different athletes talk about that. It's like you circle that on your calendar. Like, oh, I'm going to kill today. So that's great. Top 5 favorite receivers you like most watching. You don't have to give me an order. 5 guys you enjoy watching go to work in the game right now.
Right now, top 5 favorite receivers right now. I mean, Julio Jones, to start with, is just a monster. He's been a monster for a decade, probably. I love watching DK Metcalf work just because he's a physical phenom. I mean, Edelman the last few years, and I know it's hard to say anything about a Patriot, but you know, that guy's been making crazy. A killing up there. I'm blanking on a lot of people, and I'm probably not giving respect to somebody at the top. Davante Adams in Green Bay. Oh man. Yeah. So he's the most well-rounded receiver. And I love watching him because, I mean, some guys like DK Metcalf, you're just watching athleticism and monster size. I mean, clearly he's talented too, but Davante Adams has that athleticism, but then his technique as a receiver, like the dude runs good, sexy ass routes. So yeah, I love watching him work. And obviously with Aaron Rodgers as his quarterback, it's even more fun because you watch the connection. But that's what I'm putting at number one, Davante Adams.
Yeah, no, yeah, I agree. He's always, like the last couple of years, what I've been able to see from him, I was like, wow, this guy's got it. To me, it's between him and DeAndre Hopkins.
Oh, yeah.
Dude, that's my opinion. I think those are the two best right now, you know. And Mike Thomas a little bit in the Saints. I do like his game too. But for some reason, man, Davante Adams and Hopkins, they're just so high up there. Yeah. They're incredible to watch. I'm sure you still keep up a little bit with the Finns, man. What do you think about last year? They went 10-6, and now they're trying to make the playoffs this year. What do you think about Tua and them?
Yeah, I love the blueprint that Chris Greer and Brian Flores have put together. So, I mean, they clearly had a plan, and I mean, we all questioned it when they started getting blown out a couple years ago. But they got anyone off the roster that wasn't on board. You're not on board, bye. You know, no problem. They loaded up on picks. They've been building in the trenches to make sure they have a solid team to use the draft pick to get a quarterback, because then you save massive amounts of money and cap space. And now they're putting talent around him. And I think that's the, if you want to see a young quarterback take steps, it's not, in my mind, not let's get a better quarterback coach or let's change our offense. It's surround him with weapons. How can we make him as comfortable as possible? Well, let's get him people that dominate and people he can throw the ball to that he's comfortable with. They did that with Jaylen Waddle. You know, I think Tua is set to take a big step, one, because now he'll have an offseason in which he can actually, you know, like learn and process the plays, because you can't play full speed until you are 100% comfortable. And then surround him with talent. And I'm hoping they take that big jump this year and don't need to continue to use draft picks to keep building. But I love the blueprint. I'm excited about this year. I think Tua is the guy. Is he going to be a Hall of Famer? That's still a huge question mark. Is he going to be a Pro Bowler? Still a huge question mark. But have I seen enough to think that they should build around him? Absolutely.
Yeah, I agree, man. And a lot of things, we talk about injuries before. This last year, he was working on recovering from that hip injury, and he didn't have that full offseason to work on his overall game. He's kind of recovering. So him making that step from a hip injury to be able to play the quarterback position is already a big step enough. And one thing I see from him from afar, watching him on TV, watching how he handles interviews, is that he seems like a good kid, and he has those leadership skills. And I feel like you can't teach leadership skills. You can't teach accuracy. Like those are things that, you know, categorize under that it factor. And to me, I think Tua has that it factor. But what he needed was, like you said, the weapons. Now he's got a speedy guy in Jaylen Waddle to help him out there. And we got Will Fuller, who's also fast. I definitely think Tua is the guy. But I'm sure you've seen it. On the media, a lot of people have been hard on Tua and, you know, kind of giving up on him, saying he's not the guy. What was your thought? What do you think about that criticism that the national media has been giving him?
I mean, it's when you play quarterback in the NFL, you're going to be critiqued, whether you are ready 100% or not. There was a COVID offseason or an injury or not. If you go out there as a starting quarterback, you're going to get critiqued. You're not, and as a rookie, you're not going to do everything right. And so that critique is fine. That's the job. That's what you sign up for. Did he show enough where I think that there's potential there? Absolutely. But then it also didn't help that, especially because I'm in Southern California, Justin Herbert came in there as a quarterback and looked like he'd been playing for a decade. And so that also didn't help when they could have had him, but nobody predicted that. So in my mind, the critique, totally fine. That's, you know, analyze everything he does and hopefully he analyzes anything he does. And he showed enough where clearly the coaches are comfortable. They're rolling with him. But he showed enough promise where you feel like you build around him and see where it goes. Because in the NFL, you can't replace quarterbacks every year and think it's going to work out. You know, you look at the Chicago Bears, they try every year. Doesn't happen. Cleveland Browns have tried every year for the last 20 years, and they're finally getting it together because they're sticking with a guy. But unless he's a total bum, you got to stick with him and just roll with it and hope for the best.
I agree. One last question here. Do players look at that stuff? Like, do players look at the media talking bad? Like, do you watch the videos? Do you look up? Do you search it up on Twitter? I always wonder, because, you know, you don't get the responses, which is smart, obviously.
Yeah.
Tua's not going to respond, but do guys read that stuff?
The guys I was around, yes. But, I mean, I can only, you know, I can't speak for everyone, but I can speak for myself. You are aware, generally, of what's being said about you. You know, whether you go searching for it or not, someone like Tua, whose name is everywhere, if it's negative, if overwhelmingly negative, he's going to feel that. If it's overwhelmingly positive, he's going to feel that. He may not read Nando's comment down there at the bottom of a tweet that's well, you'd be hyping him up, but he's not going to read somebody else's tweet that's bashing him, but he sees it. I mean, he hears it. You can feel whether it's positive or negative without reading it directly. Some guys read it directly, but you get a feel for, you know, how your name's being said. Guys watch SportsCenter. Like, if you reach that level, like, guys, you're watching yourself. You know, you see your stuff. You know what's being said.
Yeah, I always wondered. I always wanted to ask an athlete that, because, you know, you don't see the responses. I'm like, are they still reading it? Because some people come, like, a lot of fans come down hard on people, and I'm like, man, like,
yeah, they do.
How do you guys not respond? Which is smart that a lot of people don't. Some people do, but I always wondered, like, do you guys read that? So now you're telling me you see it, they watch SportsCenter, the shows they have.
Yeah, you know the general feel. There would be times where I would read the paper and it would be positive, or I'd read the paper and it started out negative and then I'd move on. But you have a general feel for what's being said about you, what's being said about your team. Cause also your family says it, you know, your friends say it. It's not as though you're in a bubble. You know, people are sharing that information with you, whether you're hiding from it or embracing it.
That's great to hear. I always wonder, like I said, but hey, I believe Tua's going to bounce back. I think he's going to have a good year. Like I said, we're coming off 10-6. So we'll see very soon what the Dolphins are about. But Greg, I want to thank you once again for taking the time out of your day and joining me here today. And hey, good luck with everything you got going on, and stay safe out there, bro.
Appreciate it, Nando. Pleasure chatting with you.
All right, so let's get into the Miami Heat. And this past weekend, we opened up our playoff series on Saturday against the Milwaukee Bucks in Milwaukee on the road. And let's start off with game one. We lost that game 109-107. That was the final in overtime. And what a stressful game it was to watch. It was back and forth. There was no team really pulling away with a big lead at any moment in this game. The game was always within reach. Those type of games, especially in the playoffs, those are ones that have my heart racing the whole time. I mean, the anxiety was through the roof the whole game, and especially towards the end of regulation and that overtime even. I mean, I was completely stressed out. Listen, I know I've been saying I can't wait for playoff basketball, but I say that, and after having so much anxiety watching these games, I don't know. I don't know if I really enjoy it too much, you know, because it's just I'm so invested in this team and I love this team so much that when we lose and drop games, especially close games, it pisses me off for hours and hours. I'm not going to lie to you. It took me quite some time to get over that game one loss. But let's keep talking about game one here. So a few things that stand out. Positive note, Duncan Robinson was on fire. I mean, he shot 7 of 13. They were all three-pointers, so he had 7 threes. Really, really aggressive. I love what I saw from Duncan Robinson, not only offensively putting together those 24 points, but also defensively. The effort was there extremely. I saw him guard Middleton a couple plays, and he played really good defense. He played great team defense, but Middleton was just making shots, and he was making shots on Duncan Robinson. But if you look at it, Duncan Robinson was contesting all those jumpers. He was not really late on any of them. He had a good contest, in my opinion, at least. And these guys were just making shots. They were making shots, making big shots. They were, you know, embracing the overall moment of the pressure in playoff basketball. And they came through. But overall, I love what I saw from Duncan Robinson. He played 36 minutes. I have nothing bad to say about Duncan. Goran Dragic, also another one that stood out. 35 minutes off the bench. He had 5 three-pointers, 10 of 17 from the field, 25 points off the bench, only 1 assist. But listen, playoff Goran, in my opinion, that's a real thing. I mean, this guy, he's a professional. He literally gets up for these games with a mindset of, I'm going to attack and I'm going to kill. And that's what he does. That's what he does in the playoffs. I love what I've seen from Goran Dragic. Playoff Goran is a thing. That's dating back to last year even. Nothing bad to say about Goran Dragic. The three-pointers were falling this game. You think about how many threes we made. We made 20 three-pointers, shot 40% from three as a team, and still lost this game. We were 15 of 19 from the free throw line, only missed 4 free throws, as opposed to the Bucks. Look at the Bucks, 5 of 31 from three. They only made 5 threes. We made 20. They shot 16% from three. And still won that game. Look at the free throws. They shot 20 of 33 from the free throw line. They missed 13 free throws. You look at all those stats and you're like, damn, how the hell did we lose that game? Well, I can tell you one reason. We both had the same turnover, so you can't even blame it at that. But Jimmy Butler and Bam Adebayo, I mean, they did not play well at all. You look at the stats, Jimmy was able to contribute, obviously, on the defensive end. You know that's what you're going to get from him, right? He did have 10 rebounds, 8 assists, 17 points. But when you look at it, he was 4 for 22. Yeah, he sent it into overtime late in the game. I'm not mad at Jimmy Butler. Remember, I love Jimmy Butler. I always back him up on this podcast. But he did not have a good game at all. I was constantly waiting for the moment when Jimmy was going to take over the game because he was struggling from the jump shooting the ball. I believe he started 0-5 before making his first shot, which was a three-pointer. He was 2-9 from three, so he was taking the three-pointers, which I don't mind. I know he doesn't shoot a good percentage, but they were giving him the shot. And you got to take that. You have to take that. In the playoffs, you have to take the shots that are given to you and make them pay. Make them respect that three-pointer. That's what he did last year in the playoffs. If you remember, he was actually shooting a pretty good clip in the playoffs from three-point as opposed to the season. But overall, I don't mind the shots he's taken. I don't mind the amount of shots he took. He's trying to get out of that. He was trying to get something going. That's what I do like. But it was just frustrating that it never came together. I was waiting for that moment. I thought it was going to come in the fourth quarter, but unfortunately it wasn't. He did send it into overtime, like I said before. But overall, if Jimmy was on, we win this game. If he at least scores 20, 22, you know, around there, we do win this game. And it was frustrating because Jimmy Butler's been the guy all year. And it's just so crazy to have Duncan Robinson give you 24 points and Goran Dragic give you 25 off the bench, you know, for us to hit 23 pointers in the game and lose that game and not have Jimmy, who's been balling all year, not put together those, you know, those 20 plus point games that he usually puts in his sleep. So overall, it's not like I necessarily blame Jimmy. I think this is a team loss. Also, Bam Adebayo didn't play well. He was 4 of 15. He finished with 9 points, 12 rebounds, 5 assists. Of course, the stats look decent, but if you watch this game, a lot of things were frustrated with Bam Adebayo. And Bam is somebody who I always back up and I love and I still love. I'm riding with this guy throughout this whole his whole Heat career, which I hope is his whole career. But Bam Adebayo did frustrate me. I'm not going to lie to you, in this game one, so many things frustrated me, from even his rebounding. Okay, yeah, he gave you 12 rebounds, but for some reason, every time he got that rebound, he brings the ball down to like his ankle and away from defenders, and then he's getting trapped. And that's concerning to me. Every time there's like two guys around him and he's leaving the ball, it's like he's out there vulnerable to be taken. Like, listen, bring that ball up high, secure that ball, you know, space people out with your elbows, or just push it, pass the ball. I feel like there are so many instances where there could have been bad turnovers. I'm not sure if there was one or any at all, but there was instances there where Bam could have gave up that ball because he's literally leaving the ball out there for the taking on the rebounds. But that's a minor thing because, like I said, I didn't think there was really too many turnovers that were eye-popping to me that I can remember of. But little things like that. Another thing is the 4 for 15 shooting. Listen, I know Brook Lopez made an all-defensive team, I believe, last year, if I'm not mistaken. But he's Brook freaking Lopez. He's Brook Lopez. Come on now. Bam Adebayo, you are better than Brook Lopez. You got to make that guy pay. If he's giving you all the space in that drop coverage that he's playing, you got to take those mid-range shots and you got to hit them. It's playoff basketball. You can't just let these guys get away with it. There were so many instances. Again, Bam Adebayo catches the ball in the post and he's thinking pass right away. Dude, you're wide open from the middie. Take that shot. These are things I'm saying while I'm watching the game. I'm so frustrated. I feel like he literally needs to tap into that aggressive mindset and make them pay. Shoot that shot. You know what I mean? You have to take that shot. Post up. You drive by him. There's so many things that Bam Adebayo is able to do. And I feel like he's hesitant in that game one, at least. Brook Lopez, make him pay. He can't keep up with you with the speed. You beat him in speed. You can attack him. You can post up on him. I know you don't post up a lot, but Bam, you got some post moves to your game. I know it. I mean, you wouldn't be at this level if you don't have any post moves at all. So overall, I was really frustrated with his overall play. So just not having that aggressive mindset. And you look at the 15 shots. Normally, he doesn't even take 15 shots. So it kind of looks like he was trying to get out of it, but there was still times where he was hesitant. Okay, he did take a lot of shots. He did look to try to score. But I thought there was so many opportunities there where I want my guy, especially my star players, to just keep shooting. Like Jimmy Butler, 4-22. Yeah, it was frustrating, but I like that you keep shooting. You don't want to, don't let it get to you mentally where you're thinking pass because you don't have it going. No, have the mindset of make the next play, make the next play. Kobe Bryant's one, right? How many times did he have bad shooting games, but it never affected his next shot? Every play is another play. Start thinking of it mentally as you're 0 for 0 and you haven't shot. Don't let the other mistakes, you know, ruin future things that you can do. I mean, you can change a game that way. But overall, those are my thoughts on game one from a Heat's perspective. On the Bucks' perspective, man, Giannis was 10 of 27 from the field. He was 0 for 3 from 3. He finished with 26 points, 18 rebounds. He missed a lot of free throws. Overall, man, I'm not a Giannis guy. I don't think Giannis is amazing. I think he's overrated. Yeah, he's an all-star. He's a freak, of course. But listen, 10 for 27 from the field, not even shooting threes. Your mid-range sucks. Your free throws suck. All those buckets are in the paint, in transition. Mostly dunks. I mean, that doesn't amaze me. Wow, you know what I mean? But obviously, he's a freak. He is an all-star. Yes, but I just think he's overrated, okay? And it was overall frustrating to see him, you know, because I thought we had him where we wanted. He looked frustrated. When he was out there in the free throw line, he didn't look confident at all. And he was missing a lot of free throws. And also, he got called for a 10-second violation at the free throw line, which is insane because I don't think I've ever saw that in an NBA game. Obviously, I'm aware of the rule, but you saw Caron Butler out there on the sideline counting the seconds and screaming. I love what I saw from Caron Butler in the bench. That was really cool to see an assistant coach out there, like, because, you know, he's one of us. He was a former player, so he knows what it's like to have that support on the sidelines. But, man, I'm just so frustrated overall with that game one loss. And the reason why is because, you know, looking at the body language of Giannis, he kind of looked frustrated. You know, the fact that he missed 17 shots, he wasn't hitting three-pointers, he wasn't hitting his free throw shots. We were defending him pretty well. Obviously, he ended up with a lot of points, but we had him. And I thought if we won game one, we would have really messed them up mentally. I think they would have thought to themselves, like, man, they, you know, we lost to them last year. They stopped me now. We lost to them again game one, and we have home court. You know, then we'll shift home court to our advantage now. So many different things could have came from that game one loss, in my opinion. So I was overall frustrated because of that. I feel like we had them mentally screwed up. But then after game one, they win that game. They're playing with so much confidence going into game two. Now they believe they can beat us. That's 4 wins at the moment against us. And that's one thing you don't want to do in the playoffs. You don't want to give a team that doesn't deserve confidence confidence, because that could go a long way. And the reason why I say they don't deserve confidence, it's not the overall performances from these individual star athletes. It's just the 5 of 31 three-point shooting from them and the 20 of 33 free throw makes at the line. Those are alarming, and those are things that should haunt you, and you should lose a game if you perform like that, shooting from the free throw line and shooting from the three that bad. And they ended up pulling off a win, so it's like empty stats at this point. It's not concerning at all to them. Because the confidence they got, Chris Middleton was huge. He was 10 of 22. He hit that game-winning shot. He had 27 points, 6 assists, 6 rebounds. That guy is a tremendous player. They got us. I have nothing left to say, but they got us. Jrue Holiday, 20 points, 11 rebounds. He was 9 of 18. But the team is beatable. I really think we deserve to win that game one. Like I said, if Jimmy just performed to giving us 20 points, we would have won that game. Love what I saw from Goran and Duncan. But frustrating loss for game one, to say the least. Really wanted to take that one, open up the series, set in the tone. But hey, so that led us to game two. And as you guys all know, because you all saw that crap with me, it was over from the start. Where do I even start with this? I'm still disgusted. Even at the time I'm recording this podcast, how do you come out in game two with that performance? It's inexcusable. I mean, come on. We're doing this all season long, and I continue to defend this team saying, oh, it's okay. Oh, this person will be on next game. Oh, Jimmy wasn't playing this game. I'm out of excuses. There's no more excuses. This is the playoffs. What type of team gets smacked the way they did out there in game two? It's ridiculous. Because if you made the playoffs, you're supposed to be one of the top teams in the NBA. You're not the Kings. You're not the Timberwolves. Like, you shouldn't be getting smacked like that on national television in the playoffs. There should be no blowouts in the playoffs. If you're good enough to make the playoffs, you shouldn't be getting blown out. It's completely ridiculous how the Heat performed in game two, and I'm disgusted. I mean, look at it. The first quarter, it was over in the first quarter. It was over within the first 5 minutes. It was, what, 19-4 to begin the game? You got to be kidding me, right? No, this is not fake stuff. At the end of the first quarter, we were down 46-20. Come on. Bam Adebayo, not as aggressive as he should be. Do the stats look good? I'm sure you're going to get the stats looking good for certain type of players, but listen, the game was not good at all. Everybody played like crap, including Jimmy Butler. And it's so crazy because he said he's locked in, and I'm over here defending him as well. Trust me, I'm not losing faith in Jimmy. What I'm saying, it's okay if you lose a game too. Don't get me wrong. You're on the road. The series doesn't start until you lose a game on your home court. I'm pissed off about the effort, the lack of aggression, the lack to bounce back, to be professional in this sport. Come on, man. You lose game one and you come out of game two like that? What the hell is that, man? That's why I'm pissed. Kendrick Nunn last night as well. Ridiculous. He played ridiculous. I wouldn't be surprised if Coach Spo makes his adjustment and starts Goran Dragic, who he trusts more, going into game three at home. There's not much to recap. I don't even want to get into everybody's stats. I don't want to get into the percentages. I don't even want to talk about what the Bucks did. I'm sure you're all aware. I just want to share that I'm really, really frustrated with the way they performed. That's it. Like I said, it's not the loss, because I'm not concerned until you drop a game at home. So game three is going to be really important for this Heat team. I'm just pissed off about the freaking effort. That was disgusting to watch. It was ridiculous. Deadman was the only one that looked like he wanted to be out there. And that's crazy, right? We're talking about Dewayne Deadman played the best on our team. Not Jimmy. Not Bam. Dewayne Deadman. Just think about that. It's a joke. It's a joke. It's a joke the way they performed. And it's just so frustrating because I know you guys have heard me on this podcast constantly defend this team, you know, with my optimism. When I watch this game, and all I can say is when they could just continue to pour on threes, then threes and threes, I look to myself and I'm just like, wow, I defend this team so much. The way they performed out there on a playoff game, there goes to show you there's no excuses. And it's really concerning. Oh my goodness. Where can I even continue? The playmaking too was bad. Let's just flip the page. You know what? We're down 0-2. Like I said, a series is not really started until the home team drops a game. So you know what? We dropped 2 to Milwaukee. We lost the 2 games on the road. But you know what? Games 3 and 4 are in Miami. You're at your home court. You better put the hell up on game 3. You better show up. You better get the rest you need. Do whatever routine you got to do at home. You got to defend home court. There's going to be a lot of fans in the stands. They're going to be supporting your asses. I hope the Heat really bounce back and take this crap serious. Because if they drop game 3, I don't even know if there's going to be a game 5. You drop game 3, I would not be surprised if we end up getting freaking swept. And my God, I would be so pissed off if that happened. This was unexpected. This was unexpected. But you know what? If you're going to look at anything positive, the only positive that I can look at is what I've been saying. Until the home team loses a game, you're not in trouble. So you come back and you take care of these 2 games at home like you should. This is your home court. This is what it's all about in the playoffs. You have to defend that crap. So you come back. You win those 2 games, 3 and 4, tie the series up at 2, and we got a whole new series. That's the only positive going forward. That's the only thing that's keeping me afloat. That's the only thing that's going to make me want to watch this game 3, because you know what? Things can change. You win game 3, you make this 2-1, then you win game 4 with that momentum, tie it up 2-2, we got a whole new series. But one thing that can happen is the freaking effort that we saw from this Heat team in game 2. That is disgusting. But let's see. Games 3 and 4 is going to decide a lot. Game 3 is going to decide a lot about how this series is going to end up. And we're going to see what this Heat team is about. I really hope it's an easier game to watch. But we'll see. Game 3 is on Thursday, and we'll wait and see to see how our Heat do. All right, so that wraps up episode 19. Thank you all for continuing to tune into this great episode. I hope you really enjoyed that conversation with Greg Camarillo. And hopefully the Heat do big things going back at home here for game 3 and 4. We'll certainly see. I can't wait to see how that plays out. I can't wait to talk about it on the next podcast. But overall, this was a lot of fun. This was a lot of fun getting to talk to an athlete, hearing his stories, hearing about his perspective on things. And also that question about, do athletes look at social media and see what things are being said about them? I thought that was interesting because I always wanted to know personally, and I'm sure other people do as well. So I hope you enjoyed the whole interview. It was a lot of fun. I had so much fun doing it. And yeah, so we'll see how the Heat do this week. Hopefully we take care of business at home. It would be nice to win both of those games at home, but we'll see. I know I believe in this team 100%. I think we're extremely capable of advancing, doing big things. And I'm telling you, I still mean it. I'm not scared of anybody. I really think that he can match up with anybody. Once they're on, they're hard to stop. So let's see. Hopefully we protect home court. Those who are going to the game, and if you're listening to this, make some great, great noise while you go to that game, please. We need that fan energy in Miami. We need to have that place rocking, and I think it will be. All right, guys, so that wraps it up here. So I will see you guys here next Tuesday and every Tuesday after that. Thanks for listening to the Miami Sports Vibes Podcast with Nando Diaz.